What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
By the way, one of the best pictures, I don't know if you've seen this, Gabe. Have you seen the picture of George Bush sleigh riding with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No, that sounds like an amazing flashback to 1988.
Yeah, 89. It's really good. It's an amazing photo. They both have like red faces. I remember the Willie Horton ads. Do you remember as a kid seeing them?
Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
I don't remember the Willie Horton ads, but I really remember being into Dukakis and really liking him.
Yeah, I mean, my parents liked him, yeah. So it's kind of like when you're like little and people like the Yankees in your family, and then you wear a Yankees hat.
Right.
It really didn't matter to me, though.
Yeah.
I mean, really, a class president mattered more than right. A national president or whoever the crossing guard was.
Right, yeah.
Whatever that future pig, that guy who was trying to make me not jaywalk to get home.
They shaped your life a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. That guy's much more influential than whoever's running for president when you're two or three years old.
It's funny you say pig because actually...
Cops.
Right, no, cops, I know, but one of my... I always dislike
not
that.
Not all of them, but crossing
term.
Guards.
Well, the reason I don't like that term is because I like pigs. But it's funny you say that because my two areas of activism when I was in fourth grade were campaigning for Dukakis.
Okay.
And trying to legalize the adoption of Vietnamese potbelly pigs.
That's my favorite type of pig.
Yeah. So it all comes full circle. And I failed in both. But, you know, you lose a bunch of times before you win. So I stuck with it. Yeah. My parents, I remember they flipped a coin in the primary. Uh-huh. So one would vote for Jesse Jackson, who they liked more, and one
Rainbow.
Would vote for... Yep, Rainbow Coalition. And one voted for Dukakis.
Sure.
The jalobiest of non-Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Honorary Jew. Who knew a Greek could look so Jewish?
I mean, Greek, you know, they're all
Mediterranean
peoples.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of, you know, it's interesting, speaking of the death penalty, he, of course, famously said that he was against the death penalty, and then people thought they had a gotcha because it was like, what if it was your wife? What if it was your relative?
Yeah.
Which is like... First of all, there are people who are relatives of people who are killed who are very against the death penalty.
Sure.
And second of all, I'm not sure if that's the person who should be judging it.
What if Jesus, what if Mary Magdalene was the victim of a crime? Would he then be
The death penalty? Yeah.
Pro-crucifying other people?
Don't think so. Actually, I know for a fact.
Turn the other cheek.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we actually interviewed my mom. No Yo Mama jokes, please, listeners. But we did. We interviewed Nora Eisenberg. Don't be fooled by that last name. She kept her last name sometimes.
Yeah. Who knew that she was an expert?
Oh, yeah. So I know. It was funny, right? So, guys, let's have a moment of silence for the death of George Herbert Walker Bush. He died very old because, as we all know, only the good die young, and dictators and human rights violators die really old, which is more proof that God doesn't exist. in my mind, to my mind. So
I mean, they don't look good. They just live a long time.
To be fair, sure.
There's that sort of ghoulish last 45 years of a wealthy person's life where they look terrible, but the insides
are
the internal organs.
Right.
Yeah.
Those are fresh.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. He lived a very long life. 94. He was our president, of course, only one term.
But before that, he was in the CIA. Yeah, he was only in the CIA for a year, but he was there, and I don't think anybody climbs to be the head of that agency without some sort of nefarious machinations.
Right. Lots of blood on his hands.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and he definitely continued to oversee what was going on in Chile and the dirty wars in Latin America while he was the head of the CIA. I mean, the CIA also, when you look at the roots, comes from the OSS and the Dulles brothers and sort of this whole shadowy wing of the American government that's purpose is less to create freedom around the world and or even to protect us from war and more to further our grossest imperial business interests.
Right. Yeah. So it's good that he lived to 94. That's really fair. JFK, who wasn't perfect, not perfect when it comes to imperialism either, but he gets shot in the head.
Yeah.
Brains are blown out. And George Herbert Walker Bush gets to live till 94. Pinochet lives a long life. I don't know why I'm saying this. Like, I believe that we can change it, but maybe we can.
Sure. I mean, Rupert Murdoch's still alive.
Yeah, you're right. We got to take care of that.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Just kidding. Anyway, so
I don't know how old the Koch brothers are.
Yeah, they're not that old. But there is there's been a kind of orgy of whitewashing and an adulation towards George Herbert Walker Bush.
To us, he was close to perfect, but not totally perfect. And by the way, he passed these genetic defects along to us.
It reminds me of what Norman Finkelstein said this about Thomas Friedman's coverage of Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, of Saudi Arabia. He called it a protracted blowjob. He said that on Democracy Now.
All it was a very expensive...
Yeah, be careful.
It was
no cursing on this show.
No, it's not cursing, but it was a verbal blowjob, probably the most expensive one in world history, that was administered to Mohammed bin Salman.
Some people have gone after him appropriately, like Arun Gupta, Stephen Thrasher, Mehdi Hassan. And we wanted our own, we wanted to contribute to the smearing. Not smearing, because smearing implies it's not accurate.
Well, I think we can shine light on who these people are and
right.
were. And, you know, even outside of what they did during the presidency, but what the entire Bush family stands for, going back to his father, Prescott Bush, who worked for the law firm Cromwell and Sullivan. And these guys are...
Couldn't be waspier.
Yeah, they couldn't be waspier, but one of the main things that they loved doing was laundering Nazi money. So,
wow.
So, you know, I mean, because there for a while during World War II, we were on the fence as to what side we wanted to back, whether it was going to be the British and the Allies or the Axis, because the United States had a lot of interest in Germany. And not to say that they were Nazis, but that we just, you know, international capital has investments everywhere. And... The OSS, the precursors to the CIA, they had a vested interest in getting a lot of the German industrialist money out of the country before Berlin fell to the Russians.
Right.
So that, you know, Prescott's part of that.
Wow. I wish they had talked about that at the funeral. So I wanted to contribute. I wanted the Katie Halper Show to contribute to the... correcting the record of George Herbert Walker Bush, because he does have so much blood on his hands, and it's really not fair that it doesn't get recognized. So I decided I would invite someone on, and that someone, that special someone, is none other than Nora Eisenberg, who happens to be my mother. She's an award-winning novelist whose short fiction reviews, articles, and essays have appeared in such places as the LA Times, the Village Voice, the Partisan Review, the Nation, the Guardian, Tikkun, Alternate, and others. She holds a PhD in English and Comparative Literature and has taught literature and writing at Stanford University, Georgetown University, and for many years at the City University of New York, where she co-founded and for two decades directed the university's faculty publication program, a diversity mentoring program for junior faculty. She is currently working on her fourth novel set in New York City in the 1980s that chronicles the early campaigns in the war against the poor and middle class. Pretty impressive, right? My mom?
Yeah, you know, I like to see someone who's gone to gotten a little schooling.
Yeah, yeah. Is that bragging if I brag about my mom? It's not me. Can I do that? Is that like, it's kind of like when you say how cute you were as a little kid.
No, I mean, I think the more you big up your parents, the more you've got big shoes to fill.
Oh, so it's kind of self-destructive.
I mean, you know.
We could look at that. Gabe always has that, like, the opposite of silver lining. What's the opposite of silver?
Yeah. Oh, you've got a lot to live up to there, Katie.
Yeah. You may want to quiet down. She went to Columbia, and she wrote her, by the way, the university, sure. And she wrote her thesis on Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
Yeah, just wanted to shed some more light on my mom.
A room of one's own.
Yeah.
Virginia Woolf.
Yep, that's true. And she has a book called The War at Home, which is fictionalized memoirs about growing up in the Bronx. And she has a book called When You Come Home, which deals with Gulf War syndrome. And she did a lot of research into that. And so we interviewed her. And by the way, keep an eye out for the great, I think it's a very cute rapport between my mom and Gabe.
All right. Oh, thanks. I'm blushing.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. You can find The Katie Halper Show on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. And we always emphasize how when you do that, you can access bonus episodes, which are great. In fact, there's a bonus episode related to this week's recording, this week's episode, which is my mom reading from a short story she wrote at One Grand Books, which is a very cool bookstore. I have a great bonus episode that you can access now with Glenn Greenwald, which talks about how awkward it is to be formerly friends with people who you really disagree with now over politics and who are in the media and how you're supposed to write about that. And the dangers of being friends with people in the media when you cover the media. But also just want to give you the opportunity to become Patreon members if you just like the show. And in order to support the show and the work that we do, and we bring you more well-known people, and then we try to also elevate voices of people you may not have heard of. So we don't make any money off of this show except for what we make off of Patreon, which is why we encourage you to donate and support us. And if you care about these alternative voices and you care about, you know, I think we're one of the only shows that consistently pushes back on the Bernie Bro narrative. We had a Bernie Made Me White show a few years ago, and that actually was the first time Leslie Lee was on a podcast. And Leslie Lee, of course, now is the host of the very successful show Struggle Session, the co-host. So that's another reason you can support The Katie Halper Show. It's to support us elevating voices. It's so affordable. It's like you're sitting with me, not in person, buying me a drink. You're buying me and Gabe a drink. We meet up once a month. You buy us a drink. And we split a drink. You spend $5 on a drink. But if you can't buy us a $5 drink, then let's say you cover the tip for the bartender and you just give a dollar tip for the bartender, which I'm sure you would do. And so you just can donate $1 a month. And we're going to start doing a Discord chat. So that means that if you pay to support the show, we will chat with you. Another relevant bonus episode to listen to is the one we posted last week, which is with David Parsons, the host of Nostalgia Trap. And at the end of that episode, I post some really great audio of an interview I did with Dennis Mora, who was part of the Fort Hood 3, the first three men to go to jail for refusing to serve in Vietnam. They went to jail for 3 years. I have a chat with Dennis Mora, who is a good friend of the family and a good friend of my mom's and my late uncle. It relates to this because, of course, the Vietnam War, like Gulf War, were bad wars. And as you'll see in the interview, George H.W. Bush used the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, to allegedly end Vietnam syndrome once and for all. So the Gulf War was supposed to be the war to redeem America's military honor and pride. So given the death of the kinder, gentler Bush, I wanted to have someone on who could talk about some of his less... some of the darker aspects of him. And I thought to myself, hey, why not Nora Eisenberg? Because she's written a lot about Gulf War syndrome, a lot about the first Gulf War. And she has a book called When You Come Home, a novel, which is about Gulf War syndrome in part. So, Mom, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So tell us what people are not knowing, not talking about Bush.
Yeah. So, I mean, nobody likes to speak ill of the dead, I guess.
But we do here on
we
the
do. We do.
We're all about grave dancing here.
We close the door tight. The stuff that's come out about him is uniformly in the mainstream media and among mainstream politicians positive, not only as a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather, a colleague who doesn't denounce you and curse in your face and right. You know, like the president now. So, you know, everybody looks good, but there's also the political habit of manufactured consent of the media and political leaders. So what we had really, though, with Bush was a very sinister leader. You know, he wore gray suits and he didn't color his face or his hair, but he did some really treacherous things, as people have been pointing out, like Mehdi Hasan and Anthony DiMaggio in the independent media, like Intercept right. and Counterpunch. There's another side to him, his ads that really helped win him the election against Michael Dukakis were amazingly racist. So there's Willie Horton, there's the overkill or unnecessary kill or the invasion of Panama
right.
to bring home Noriega, who was a good friend.
Before he wasn't.
And what else? Irangate. And he pardoned all of the, I mean, in terms of, and I think this is something that Mehdi Hasan mentioned in his Intercept article, that he pardoned all of the Weinberger and others who were being investigated for Irangate, the Iran-Contra affair. And so he really obstructed justice. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about mostly is his involvement in the 91 Gulf War. It's almost 29 years since. And in that period, the dominant story is that it was the best American war. And it corrected the worst American war, Vietnam. So he said specifically, we kicked Vietnam syndrome once and for all and brought glory to America. We didn't inhibit our troops by having them feel ashamed, which according to that story, the protesters had inflicted on the troops, so they had no will. And they were sloppy and demoralized, and we restored national pride and will. So no more Vietnam syndrome. Of course, the war gave us Gulf War syndrome, but that we'll get to later. So it's been hailed as the best war, and
since World War II?
No, ever, because it was fought in 43 days.
43 days. Yeah.
43 days. We lost 148. Troops, a third by friendly fire,
wow.
And we were in and out. And that's the story. It doesn't really go beyond that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now with the War of the Sun, Bush 43, it's even risen in stature, Bush 41's war, because we're seeing it as we're being told it's the good Gulf War.
Right. Because we lost so many fewer people, killed so many fewer people, right?
Yes, right. What's less known, I mean, at the time of the war, there was some excellent reporting. James Ridgway in The Village Voice did a great series on how there was a sudden push to war. It had been a very unpopular war. You kids may remember in the summer time, because Katie, I think we went to a big rally in Central Park. People were really opposed to the war. And I mean, they never heard of Kuwait.
Right.
Well, how long had Kuwait been a country?
Is it like
a real country? Or
well, there's,
kind of...
yeah. I mean, there's that argument that it was an imperial creation, right?
Yeah. Like after World War II, didn't the British just chop up the Middle East and
right,
say,
right.
now this is a country?
Right.
And Kuwait's only...
The Britishification.
Yeah, it's basically just access to the Gulf.
So, yeah, and what happened after the Iran-Iraq, was it 8-year war? Saddam's position was that he was bankrupt and that the Kuwaitis were siphoning off oil and that they had benefited from his, the whole region had benefited from his controlling the Iranians, the, you know, the fundamentalist Iranians and fundamentalism in the region. But anyway, back to the selling of the war. I mean, that's important in terms of Kuwait and what it was and the manufacturing of a story. You know, the invasion was not sweet, I'm sure. You know,
right.
But as we can talk about, by all indications, we gave Saddam a green light to go in through our State Department, through the Undersecretary of State, April Glaspie. And, you know, I think what happened probably is that Bush was vacillating between a more, an older, more thoughtful State Department and a really agitated Department of Defense under Dick Cheney. And that the neocons won. I mean, he might later, of course, call them the crazies sometimes. But, you know, they and Margaret Thatcher called the shots. So what we know now is that the war had been in the planning for years, just like the 2003 Gulf War. And not that all parts of the government were in agreement on it, but there was... In October 1990, Colin Powell referred to a new military plan for Iraq developed the year before, right at the end of the Iran-Iraq war. So we supported them to do our job there, even though we undermined it by supporting Iran as well, our job, and the containment of fundamentalism. And Schwarzkopf in 1990, early 1990, so that's a year before the 91 Gulf War, told the Senate Armed Services Committee about a new military strategy in the Gulf to control U.S. access to oil. And it was boldly stated like that. It was a very unpopular war, as we said, and in the course of a few months, it became a popular war by totally manufactured narrative. So what we know, and this has been written about pretty widely, not by the mainstream press, but by less by the mainstream press and more by independent journalists. So we know that it was there was a lot of planning about some sort of Iraq military intervention a year before the war. And we know that April Glaspie gave Saddam Hussein the green light.
Set him up.
Now, whether Bush was directly in on that, whether Baker was sneaking around, you know, we don't really know that yet. But we do know that she said, yes, certain circles in the U.S. government are antagonistic to you, but you can be assured, and I've communicated with Secretary Baker, that we extend friendship and we will be non-confrontational. And it is our policy to view such actions as Arab to Arab and not in the purview of the U.S. So that's what happened. And then he invades in the summer. And still, they're saying, well, we don't know. You know, we have no plans. And I think what happens is that, you know, there are wings of government. You know, there are tendencies. And we were seeing the rise of the neocons at that time. So they entered on August 2nd. So he had no reason to believe there'd be retaliation. So we're not sure exactly where Bush was in this. But what we know is that once he invaded and it got discussed, there was a will to war. That's the camp that won out. And Bush came out of that in early August really focused. But again, we had a very unpopular, there was not great support for it.
So you brought up, there's something interesting for me, and I don't know if you can answer this, but George Bush is at the top of the pyramid, the hierarchy of people. All information flows up to him, supposedly, because he's the commander in chief.
Right.
But then... we have State Department people who are flying to Iraq and meeting with foreign leaders and possibly not informing him?
No, no. I mean, but they have said that Glaspie was just, she was a very seasoned diplomat, but they said that she bungled. Mm-hmm. And
did she have to fall on her sword?
Yes, yes. I don't remember where she ended up, but it wasn't in a good place.
Guam.
Yeah. And I mean, and she reported that I've spoken to Baker, and he says it's an Arab affair.
Meaning that the U.S. would not intervene, right?
Exactly. Anyway, over the course of the summer, the administration spent over $11 million to pay for a PR campaign by the lobbying PR group, Helen Knowlton. Now, this is interesting. The Washington office of Helen Knowlton was headed by Craig Fuller, who was a close friend of Bush 41 and his chief of staff when he was vice president. So he was in charge of this almost $12 million campaign. So they did all this AstroTurf stuff, you know, rallies all over the place, videos, news, anyway.
Like Wag the Dog.
Exactly. And
what celebrity endorsements did they get?
Yeah.
That's a, yeah. Was Bo Jackson like, Bo knows the Iraq right. war.
So there's a book called, it was a documentary, I'm sorry, by this Canadian Broadcasting Corporation called To Sell a War. And it talks about how the research arm of Helen Knowlton kind of worked this out. And they did these, I guess, focus groups and tested various descriptions and narratives for Saddam Hussein. And they have him saying, one of the researchers saying, Saddam Hussein was a madman who had committed atrocities even against his own people and had tremendous power to do further damage.
Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation. No threat to his own. Saddam sought to add to the chemical weapons arsenal he now possesses an infinitely more dangerous weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear weapon.
That was the decided narrative.
Our goal is not the conquest of Iraq. It is the liberation of Kuwait.
The oil thing receded as a stated reason, and they used the human rights issue as, you know, as various administrations often do.
The terrible crimes and tortures committed by Saddam's henchmen against the innocent people of Kuwait are an affront to mankind and a challenge to the freedom of all.
The most, and you probably know about this, the most amazing concoction by this Helen Knowlton group was the creation of a bogus committee called the House Human Rights Caucus. It had no legitimate authority, but they wanted it to pass as a congressional committee. It was really a simulation. There was a young woman, Naira, she said she'd seen, we know this script already, the Iraqi soldiers came into the hospital with guns and go into the room where babies were in incubators. They took the babies out of the incubators, took the incubators and left the babies on the cold floor to die. She said she was traumatized because she had been a volunteer in a maternity wing or hospital, and she wept before the caucus, and she was still shaken by the atrocity she witnessed at Kuwait City Hospital.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Nayira, and I just came out of Kuwait. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my five-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There was no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer, Other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
So we know that she was a Kuwaiti royal. Her father was the ambassador, Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S., and she'd never volunteered at any hospital. This was just a creation of the
She's
PR
brown,
firm.
She's Arab. The right. American population won't know the difference.
Bush repeats this in, you know, in when he's explaining the war.
He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities. And among those maimed and murdered, innocent children.
Yeah, killing babies always makes people upset.
Yeah.
And but this also was in World War One, what they were talking about with the Germans when they called them the Huns, like bayoneting little like babies and stuff.
Right.
Belgium or wherever right. first ended up.
Right, yeah.
Then to sell the war, there was the satellite images of Iraqis moving towards Saudi Arabia, which, of course, we knew what we needed for oil. So the St. Petersburg Times hired independent satellite, and nothing showed up. So that's another thing. It went on and on, the deceptions that sold the war to the American people, but it was really a fabrication, the human rights stuff. And they stated that in the resolution that they brought to Congress, by the way, Bush said he would have prosecuted the war even if the resolution hadn't passed, but it was very limited. It was to eject the Iraqis from Kuwait very quickly. And you probably remember this from the CNN coverage. That very quickly it became, to destroy Iraq, because there were a lot of civilian targets. The entire infrastructure was devastated, from water systems, purification systems, bridges, office buildings, highways, roads, and the estimates of civilian death in that war range from 25,000 to 100,000, half of them, of course, children. In immediate casualties, the casualties in after the war.
These were like civilian casualties?
Yes, yes.
So even if Saddam had been killing his own people or killing other people, this was a massive collateral damage.
Yeah.
Depose him, not even depose him. Right. But just
now, interestingly, the legislation to prosecute the 91 Persian Gulf War was it never ended legally, and people in the State Department since then have used it strategically to justify legally the approval to bomb or continue the aggression in the area.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. It's kind of like how we never ended the war with North Korea.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And this is really, it's not ended. It's probably the longest American war.
Yeah.
Yeah. So another thing was that, one of the reasons we don't know that much about it, besides the complicity of the self-serving of politicians and the complicity of the media, is at the time there was a tremendous censorship, and probably habit of self-censorship to be in the good graces of the administration. So we really had to rely on some good souls in the good journalists, like in CNN, and also people like Seymour Hersh. Another thing that we don't know about is that the creation of Al-Qaeda in the region, Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, can really be linked to the Gulf War, because what we did was bring our troops into the country that had the most holy of Islamic sites. I mean, it was Mecca.
So we were stationing our troops in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought I said that. Yeah, we were stationing our troops. We used that satellite as a reason, but really, we went in and we established bases in Saudi Arabia that were there for decades. So in reaction to that, I mean, even in the beginning, the Saudis were reluctant to let us in because of the holy sites. But once they let us in, then Osama bin Laden, who was, you know, a hero and from one of the elite families, hero of the Afghanistan war and one of the elite families, he left the country, exiled, and declared jihad on the U.S. It's really hardly been looked at, that it was a very specific fatwa jihad. We do hear often it was the duty of every Muslim to kill the Americans and their allies, civilians and military. That's been quoted widely. But the second part of the sentence we don't hear about, which is in order to liberate the Aqsa Mosque and the Holy Mosque, which is Mecca, from their grip, and in order for their armies to move out of all the lands of Islam, defeated and unable to threaten any Muslim. So it was not only the holy sites, but it was also the brutal overkill of the Iraqi facilities and population that spurred him on. So it's very specific.
Spurred Osama bin Laden on.
Yes, spurred Osama bin Laden on. It's really hardly been looked at.
Yeah, there's more of a general thing about how we trained him in the Cold War, the Mujahideen, but people don't actually make the connection. Although he did, if you read his speech, he makes the connection to the Iraq War, specifically.
But it's not repeated in the media. So we did very, very brutal things over there besides the infrastructure. I mean, we broke all kinds of international law, military law, civil understanding, civility. So that when there had been a ceasefire brokered by the UN and the about-to-die Soviet Union, and the Iraqi soldiers had their cannons in reverse, they were retreating from Kuwait on this highway between Basra and Kuwait City, and we just, for a night, just killed them dead. We basically incinerated just about every car on the road. And they were included a lot of Palestinians, civilians, who knew they were about to be slaughtered because they were sympathetic. And they had a very degraded existence in Kuwait as near slaves, and they were sympathetic to Iraq. So they were going to be slaughtered. So they left Kuwait. Anyway, there were families and civilians and retreating bedraggled soldiers, and they were incinerated. Now
that's called the highway.
Highway of death. Yeah.
Bombs were dropped on the front and rear of the procession, trapping the rest of the vehicles in between.
The headlights all went out. But because of the reflections of the oil fires and the twilight cast by the low clouds, I was able to still see all the vehicles on the road. Could see people jumping out of vehicles, could see doors opening, could see vehicles turning off into the sand, as well as those that we hit with our bombs.
And partly responsible for this, and we don't know how rogue it was Barry McCaffrey, who then became Clinton's drug czar. And, a much featured face on news shows. And nobody talks about him as a war criminal. So I want to talk about two or three other things that are often not talked about in relation to this good Gulf War. And one is the poisoning of our own. Now we know that after the 91 war and the ensuing sanctions that over a million people died. And there was tremendous amounts of cancer, babies being born deformed, all kinds of ill health. In every way, it was a disastrous decade and beyond, probably. But what's less known is that our own came home sick with something like a lot of them over there were suffering from. So this is an interesting story because you know how the Vietnam soldiers had so much trouble having their PTSD taken seriously. Now these returning troops were suffering with physical ailments, from memory loss to ALS to, we think, multiple sclerosis and brain brain cancers that showed up a little later. And here you had the government saying to them, it's in your head, we'll give you some counseling. So they caught up, you know, they caught up to PTSD, but then they applied it to people suffering from obvious physical maladies.
Right. Not just psychological. Then.
Right. So that is something that's still going on now. There's been a whitewash of it. There's been a real war between the scientists who were assigned by Congress to research Gulf War illness. The VA under Shinseki went and slashed that committee because it was saying we see a causative relationship between wartime exposures and these real diseases. And we point to particular neurotoxins used in particular instances. One was the PB medication, which was used for myasthenia gravis, but it was done like 20-fold or 10-fold and had never been used that before. So these soldiers became sick almost instantly, many of them. They were court-martialed if they didn't take it. This was to protect them from nerve gas exposure.
So I have a friend who, Tom Sullivan, who was a sergeant in the military. He was in the Marines, and he had to take this. He was inoculated with vaccines for whatever they were contracting out there. And he had multi-system organ failure, and it debilitating. Like, it happened rapidly, but he left behind a wife and kids. And now there's a fund for him. But that's a huge issue.
That's right. So you know that firsthand.
They didn't really do much about that, and they didn't tell his family what the problem was. So
no,
his brother and his surviving family's advocates for helping get veterans help with Gulf War syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now it's made it to its way from being called a syndrome to an actual illness. But the VA has been at war, as this committee, this research advisory committee, which was established by Congress in 2004. I know I'm going into a lot of detail, so you can just cut it out later. As they became clearer and clearer about the linkage, also to sarin, which we when we bombed a munitions depot where we knew there was sarin in Kaimisia, and the plume went far and wide, you know, all the way to Saudi Arabia, it's claimed. But so those people, there seems to be linkages to brain cancer. But and then the third thing was the incredible overuse of DEET, which
that's for mosquitoes.
Yeah, and sand fleas, which they did, you know, wanted to protect the troops from.
Huh? Who knew about that? Sand fleas.
Sand fleas.
I always thought the desert was pretty sterile. Like, you weren't really going to contract.
Well,
bed
anyway,
bugs
I mean, again, it's probably the same friends in the petroleum and you know, pharmaceutical industry that are selling the same products.
That's great. I'm sure the soldiers would prefer to have brain cancer than sand fleas and mosquitoes.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Because those bites are really annoying.
Right. So anyway, this is something that's a real horrible situation for the veterans. They've been knocked around for almost three decades now. The VA has demolished this prestigious committee it put together because it came out with some very, very clear findings and recommendations. And so now it has a new form, but it's sort of mushing everything that was said before and found before. One other thing, or two other things I want to talk about, are the mass murders or vile murders, really notorious murders that occurred after the Gulf War by Gulf War veterans. You know, John Muhammad, the Beltway sniper.
Yeah, when he was out there operating in the Beltway, my sister was in soccer practice at a school in Maryland, and they had to cancel a lot of the practices. It was a big deal, especially for, you know, parents picking up their kids at like around 3 o'clock in that area. It was
right,
caused
right,
massive
right, right,
terror.
Yeah, well, he ended up murdering 10 people and injuring a bunch of others. He had this kid at his side.
Malvo,
John Malvo.
Yeah.
And Malvo, I mean, he had kidnapped him. And it's strange that that was never taken into account.
Very Patty Hearst. But, yes. But a white woman who's wealthy can claim brainwashing.
Yeah, and a black kid is on his own.
Yeah.
But the thing about John Muhammad is that he... by all accounts, went to Iraq a really nice guy and came back insane. His wife wrote a book for Simon & Schuster, I think. Her name is Muriel or something. And Mildred Muhammad wrote a book called Scared Silent about what happened to him when he came back from the war. And the sniper stuff was all somehow involved with threatening her too.
Right.
Yeah.
The theory is that he could cover up murdering her.
Yeah.
If he had created a spectacle where people thought it was terrorism.
That's right.
Yeah. And so she was going to be his final victim.
Yes. Yeah.
I love true crime. Can't get enough.
His mental illness never came up in the trial. And this is so sad. Till the end, he maintained his innocence, claiming at the time of the killing spree, he was in Germany for dental work.
Yeah.
He had become schizophrenic.
I travel when I want surgery too, though. So I get it.
Right.
He's just a single payer advocate.
Yeah, right. His lawyers did not mention that he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, that there were brain scans documenting profound malformations consistent with psychotic disease. And Tim Kaine said, crimes that are this horrible, you just can't understand. It's, you know, they can't understand theory.
Meaning like it can't be mental illness? Like don't bother trying to understand it? Even though he's an anti-death penalty guy, Tim Kaine.
Yeah, yeah. Was he then too?
I think he has been for a while, but I wonder if he was saying that in a sympathetic way or not.
No, not at all. Because the state of Virginia, it was because he was the governor of Virginia, and
right.
there was some,
and he has said
that was one of the areas.
The death penalty, he has to carry it out. But that has always been one of the stupidest arguments I've ever heard, which is like the more severe and crazy the crime. It's a similar thing with kids. When kids commit an adult crime, like you're supposed to try them as adults, but it's really like, that's pretty much a sign that they're really messed up.
Yeah, they agreed, the lawyers, that he was psychotic, but they didn't link it to Gulf War, his Gulf War experience, and that he was stationed in Kamisia, which is where the sarin explosions were. And that's what the brain cancer seems to have derived from, and his deformed brain into schizophrenia. So let me talk about another Gulf War veteran, Lewis Jones. He was executed, of course, so was Muhammad, and the Malvo was serving a life, like 10 life sentences.
Also Timothy McVeigh, wasn't it?
Yeah, I want to talk about Timothy McVeigh. But this is another situation where somebody just killed, a nice guy just killed, I think, a young female soldier and raped and murdered her. And scans showed immense brain damage. And again, he was executed. He was also in Kamisia, where the sarin was. And I also want to talk about Timothy McVeigh. You know, you're not allowed to talk to him because some crimes are so heinous that they can't be spoken of, and you know, as if they were done by humans when we know these aren't humans. But McVeigh, I don't know. There are no scans of his brain, but again, by all accounts, he went to war idealistic. He didn't like the big bullies trying to scare little Kuwait. And then when he was there, he was shocked by what he saw. He said that he saw the highway of death. He saw the highway of death, and where we corralled and massacred in one night, February 26, 1991. And in his famous 60 Minute interview with Ed Bradley, he said that changed him. He found himself thinking, I'm in this person's country. What right did I have to come over to his country and kill him? How did he ever transgress against me? He went over thinking with Bradley, not only is Saddam evil, all Iraqis evil, that's what he thought, but quickly it was an entirely different ball game. Face to face, you realize they're just people like you. He told Bradley the government modeled brutal violence. In a 1998 prison essay, he objected to the United States' continuing campaign against Iraq. It was the U.S. that had set the standard, he said, for stockpile and use of weapons of mass destruction. So on the highway of death, they used, 500-ton bombs of napalm and depleted uranium. And he said, when he came back, something didn't feel right in me, but I couldn't say what it was. We don't know. He could have been it could have been chemical exposure. It could have just been the trauma, which we now know from neuroscientists actually deforms the brain too. You can see PTSD, severe PTSD on a scan. So what I want to say too is that, so that we have to look at this, the violence after, we have to look at the sickness after, we have to look at the sickness over there, the degradation of a whole country and soon region, and the relation of Bush 41's war and the wars that followed. And as I said, legally, it laid the foundation. In terms of the overkill, it set the standard, to quote Timothy McVeigh. We know that international law now will not view the actions of individuals in war as a crime, the international courts, but the leaders. Now, he's not around anymore to be tried by any international court, if it ever could be, if we could ever find one to try him. But there's such a developing mass of information about his ignoble, illegal, and brutal policies in prosecution of the war that I think that history is going to have to judge him.
But he's so polite.
He's so polite, yeah.
You know, relative to these bombastic guys in charge now.
Well, I mean, Trump has given everyone, every imperialist, every warmonger, every liar, a good look.
The thing is Trump has the lowest body count so far.
No, that's a really good point.
So far.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan. I mean,
No. How could you be?
Also, Trump, it's ironically, on this John Schwartz interview that I did, I played Trump discussing Bush, and he actually called Bush a liar. This is when he was running. And he said, the guy interviewing was like, well, a liar? Don't you mean he was just like mistaken? He goes, well, if he could have gotten it wrong, but if you're lying because you want to settle a score because of your dad, like he brought up the George Bush 1 thing and how that influenced George Bush 2 in the Iraq War.
That's one theory, yeah.
Do you think that had anything to do with it?
I don't know.
What do you think motivated?
The neocons, they claimed the father and they claimed the son. They were just out to do their thing, to become.
I'm shedding some tears that there are war criminals that we don't have the opportunity to prosecute. But you brought up the neocons. We've still got Wolfowitz.
Yeah.
We've got Pearl. Bremer. We've got who else?
Pearl.
Sure. Pearl? Let's throw a Pearlman in there.
Let's throw in a Pearl, Yitzhak Pearlman or whatever. But and then there's Cheney. Paul Bremer, as you said, who else is there?
Anyway, a lot of bad guys are still bumping around. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, right. So what about Henry Kissinger? Is he considered a neocon? He's real politique, but he's another guy who gets praise.
Yeah. Well, we could do it. You could do another whole show on
him.
But, it's amazing. So he's being hailed now as the uber civil gentleman. And and with humane policies, and nothing could be less true. The thing that really sticks with me is the murders here and the mass murders here, like John Muhammad, and also the illness of American troops, you know, which is, you know, they, what happened to that Obama pastor who said chickens come home to roost?
Jeremiah Wright.
They really did in the body of these troops.
He was referring to 9/11, but yeah, it applies to this
he
also.
Right? Yeah, it applies to this also. They also, I mean, there's indication, and Life magazine did a big spread on this, that there are serious birth defects in the children of Gulf veterans, and they link that particularly to depleted uranium. The scientific committee I referred to before is up in the air about depleted uranium. They don't say it hasn't had an effect. They just haven't studied it enough. So you have that. And people said, well, how can that be? Everything was drenched in oil. They brought home their uniforms, their blankets, whatever. And it seeped into, the thought is, into their bodies and into their semen. A lot of the wives said they had this burning semen. And a number of children, it's been said, a higher number of birth defects among Gulf War vets. But the way this war, I mean, you don't know where to begin faulting it, but the way this war ushered in Al-Qaeda is astonishing and so underappreciated. So much for the gentle Bush.
The kinder, gentler Bush.
You know, the Iraq War, in those 43 days, there was more firepower unleashed than in the history of wars altogether. It became the show-off ground for the new American empire. The Soviet Union was breathing its last breaths. And this was the New World Order, as Bush called it. And that meant that we were in charge. We were unfettered by the communist world, unchallenged. And so we were showing what we could do as the big cheese on the globe. Right. And so we showed off every new piece of equipment and every new kind of bomb and depleted uranium and on and on and on.
One thing that's interesting about the Cold War ending, I remember in middle school, my sixth grade teacher, he was pretty ahead of the curve, but he said, well, now that that's over and the enemy is no longer the Russians, it's going to be the Arabs. And he wasn't saying this in a way where he's like, hooray, but he was like, well, like, and we're trying to wrap our minds around just like world politics as sixth graders. But he's like, that's the next frontier, which was basically like the neocon platform to do with the new world order.
Right.
We need new enemies.
Right.
You know?
And just as they were planning this, as the Soviet Union was unraveling with our help, I'm sure, they planned the 203 invasion and occupation based on, you know, years of thinking. What was it called? The new plan for the new American century or something. So it was all in the works before, right. And they needed the excuse, and which was, in both cases, was pretty bogus.
Well, also in terms of what you guys were saying about the Cold War, I remember hearing Tariq Ali saying that like the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union was so bad because it gave the anti-Americanism, the only real like avenue for that was fundamentalism, like Islamic fundamentalism, which is a much less rational partner to negotiate with than the Soviet Union was.
Right.
Which people may think is unwoke, but it's totally true, and it's fundamentalism.
Yeah, I know. I mean, what if we didn't see it just as the evil empire, but we saw it as a country? Everything went crazy in the world. The whole balance of power, just as it has with Iraq falling. These people were holding a lot down.
Right.
Saddam was really doing a lot to
He was doing the Lord's work with a secular government in the Middle East.
Right. Right.
You know, regardless of whether you liked his Ba'athist policies, he wasn't a theocrat, and women could drive.
Most of the doctors were women. They had free education, free higher education, free welfare. I mean, it was an enlightened state, much like Syria was. In terms of education and public services.
Well,
was benign.
Right. But they weren't fundamentalists.
They weren't fundamentalists, and they were the most secular and evolved.
Right.
Arab countries.
Also, another thing that Trump said in that same interview where he was talking about Bush being a liar, another thing he said was, look, Saddam Hussein's a really bad guy, but there was no terrorism then. Now, going to Iraq, all the terrorists are going to Iraq. It's like the Harvard of terrorism, which is true.
Right.
We don't, no one likes to say this, but he did provide a lot of stability. Speaking of core exercises and crunches, he did stabilize the region a lot. So, all right, this was great, Mom. This is great, Nora Eisenberg. Thank you so much for this.
Great being with you guys.
Yeah, I learned a lot.
Oh, yeah. I love the refresher course on the Iraq War. I think this is more informative than what Ken Burns' documentary is going to be about the subject.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. You and my mom know a lot about the same. You were both really interested in the subject.
Can't get enough.
Yeah.
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 I love true crime.
True crime, yeah.
I like war.
Yeah.
So put those two things together and you get war crime.
Right.
True war crime.
Yeah. That we should do a series on that.
That's my lane.
All right, cool. So Gabe, what's going on with you? Anything that you want to tell people about, listeners about?
You can always find me on my other podcast, Eat, Pray, Judge. So download that and subscribe to it as well. It's a film podcast, and it's not quite as heavy as this. And you can find me every Wednesday at Funhouse Comedy. The show is at 10 p.m. It's always free, and it's live stand-up.
Awesome. Thanks so much for listening to Katie Halper Show. And you can find me on Twitter at Katie Halps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. And you can find the Katie Halper Show on Facebook. You can use the hashtag KT Halp Show. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. And yeah, great.
All right, peace.
Peace in the Middle East. Thanks so much again for listening to the Katie Halper Show. Please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. If you like this show, if you like hearing voices like Nora Eisenberg's, who happens to be my mom, if you like hearing stories and history that you may not have learned about that the rest of the media doesn't bring you, if you like hearing people like, you know, Glenn Greenwald and Naomi Klein and Matt Chrisman, Leslie Lee, David Parsons, Nina Turner, Greg Grandin, we're going to have Ricky Rawls on soon. Great voices. The Katie Halper Show is edited by Ted Reedy. And our theme show music is by Cordoba.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.